This past week, you need a lesson up here, Greg, or two. Josh needs one. We spent Sunday just introducing the book. Well, the books of Judges and Ruth, and we talked more along the lines of the time period rather than specifically the book of Judges and the book of Ruth. How this is a specific period of time in the Bible history or in the Bible story. And we talked about some things that are germane to that time period. Thank you. And tonight we're getting into the actual text of Judges chapter 1. Although if you look at the outline, and I've got a few books that I've consulted for this, and more than one writer suggests this, that the introductions to the book of Judges, and there's more than one, that this doesn't fall all within chapter divisions. As you'll see at the top of page 5 here, Judges chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2 and verse 5, some writers suggest that that's the first introduction. And then Judges chapter 2 and verse 6 through 3 and verse 6, if you look on page 7, that is the second introduction. And they run sort of parallel. They further introduce the spirit of the times. They talk about the state of Israel, her lack of faith in many ways, maybe some elements that led to her unfaithfulness, that led to her repeated apostasy in one respect or another. And so you don't actually get to the stories of the judges until chapter 3 and verse 7 and following. And so you'll see that will be in lesson 3 when we get there. The remainder of chapter 3 covers the first three judges, Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. So these first two lessons that we'll talk about tonight, Lord willing, on Sunday, chapter 1 and chapter 2, they are just more or less an introduction, if you will, to the days of the judges and some of the initial efforts of Israel in rooting out the inhabitants of Canaan, the Canaanites. Here in chapter 1, I think we can see a clear demarcation line or a division, if you will, between some successful campaigns in driving out Canaan and being somewhat successful. And then at the end of chapter 1, we see some very marked failures when they did not drive out the Canaanites. And so we'll make that note as we get to between verse 21 and verse 22 of chapter 1. So let's talk about the questions here in lesson 2. And before we get to the actual text of the book, I wanted to spend at least the first question in a couple of Old Testament passages, Numbers 33 and Joshua 23. So as you read those two passages for the first question, and you see there sort of the statement at the end of question 1, I want you to keep thinking about these two passages as you go throughout the lesson. So let's first turn to Numbers 33 and verses 50 through 56. Numbers chapter 33, starting in verse 50. Who's speaking throughout the book of Numbers? Moses. What's about to happen to Moses? He's going to die, which means he won't get to do what and why. He won't get to go into the land of Canaan because why? His own sin. He disobeyed God when God said, "Speak to the rock." Moses struck the rock. And we can go back and we can find that account where God said, basically, because you've not obeyed me, you've not shown me honor and those kinds of statements, then you will not enter into the land of Canaan. You will suffer the consequences for your sin. But he spends the book of Numbers going through about four or five sermons or speeches, where he gives some warnings, he gives some admonitions or some exhortations about the blessings of being faithful and the warnings of not being faithful. And this is a warning, Numbers 33, let's start in verse 50. Moses says, well, Moses writes, that the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, now here's his warning, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their molten images and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land
and live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. And you shall inherit the land by lot according to your families. To the larger you shall give more inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give less inheritance. Wherever the lot falls to anyone, that shall be his. You shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. So at least down through verse 54, God is just telling Moses to tell the sons of Israel, when you cross over the Jordan, here are some of the general procedures and how you're to apportion out the land. And by the way, who decided the boundaries of each portion? Who decided who got what? God decided all that. I mean, it wasn't just, let's flip a coin or let's divvy it up on our... No, God decided who would live where. But these are just the general procedures, if you will, as to how they would divide up the land. Now, what we really want to emphasize here, starting in verse 55. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them shall become as pricks in your eyes and as thorns in your sides, and they shall trouble you in the land in which you live. And it shall come about that as I plan to do to them, so I will do to you. Now, does that directly involve what we're talking about in this quarter? It does. Because they failed to drive out the Canaanites. When they got in there and drove them out, they were to destroy all their idolatrous ways, their lifestyle, their gods. But what about the people? They were to drive them out too. But what do we see happen in the book of Judges? And we'll see it time and time again, especially in these first chapters. They let them live. They let them remain. And what did Moses say here, the verse that we're reading? If you let them sort of hang around, it's going to be nothing but trouble for you. There'll be thorns in your sides and pricks in your eyes. You ever had an irritant in your eye before? How does that feel? Well, it's not very comfortable, obviously. And that's the point that God's making. It's going to be irritable for you. It's going to be nothing but constant agony and problems and trouble and discomfort. It's not going to be a help to you. It's going to be a hindrance to you in trying to serve me. So there's this warning that Moses gave before he died. Well, that's what Moses said. Now Moses dies, and we come to the second passage here in question one. Turn to Joshua 23. Of course, it's the book right before Judges. Joshua 23. I have listed there in the question verses 1 through 13. We won't read all of that. But let's pick up in verse 8. Well, before we read, starting at verse 8. Verse 4, we'll just make a few notes here. Verse 4, Joshua says to them that these nations in whom they're going to go in and dispossess, I have apportioned these nations which remain as an inheritance for your tribes. Verse 5, what's God going to do as what Joshua says? Okay, God's going to run them out. God's going to drive them out of there. Of course, that did mean that Israel didn't have to be involved, but it's going to be God working through Israel to dispossess those nations. So God was going to take care of that. He will thrust them out, drive them out from before you, and then you shall possess their land. The admonition in verse 6, but you be firm to do what God said, to obey the covenant. Verse 7, don't associate with these nations. Don't intermarry with them. Don't cling to them. So the teaching was, you have nothing to do with these peoples. You're acting as a judgment tool of the Lord to get rid of these nations. Now, verse 9. For the Lord has driven out great and strong nations from before you. Had God already done that since their deliverance from Egypt? Yes, He had. He had given them multiple victories over nations mightier and greater than they. And God was behind all that effort, those successes. Verse 11, so take diligent heed to yourselves to love the Lord your God, for if you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, these which remain among you, and intermarry with them, so that you associate with them and they with you, know with certainty that the Lord your God will not continue to drive these nations out from before you, but they shall be a snare and a trap to you, and a whip on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land. So Moses warned before he died. Well, what's Joshua doing here? Exact same thing. Joshua's telling them, Now, by the time Joshua speaks, which is Joshua 23, have they already been somewhat successful in driving out some of the nations? Yes, they had done that. But was the job complete? The job was not complete. And so sort of as some of his parting words, basically what's Joshua say to do? Finish the job. Drive these nations out. Do not let them remain. Do not intermarry with them. Don't associate with them. Don't strike up friendships with them. You've got to get rid of them. That's the Lord's will about this. And if you fail to do this, it's going to be nothing but trouble for you. Okay. All right. I don't either, Freddie. I don't know about that either. But at least in these warnings that took place, one before they crossed the Jordan, before Moses' death, and then with Joshua's warning, after he had done that work somewhat, but not yet complete, the admonition is, you get rid of all of them. You drive them out totally. Do not let them remain. Yes, Doug. Of what, Joshua 23, verse 7? Okay. Yes. Absolutely. That's always been God's concern, that if they strike up relationships, friendships, intimate associations with the pagans, it wasn't that God, well, I don't like those people, and I don't want you to be friendly. No, it's because they serve pagan gods, and they'll take your heart away from serving me, and you'll wind up serving the idols. And that's correct. That is the main concern God had. So here are these previous warnings. And I want us to not forget that these two statements were said before we ever get to the first judge, the first story of the judges. So keep these in the back of your mind as we go through this lesson. And really, it sort of sets the tone, I think, for the rest of the book, for the entire time period. It was a reminder that they basically failed to do what God said to do with respect to these nations. And it was nothing but problems and troubles. And so this sets the tone for this entire time period. Okay? Now, let's look at the initial inquiring. This gets us to question two. Despite the book's overall disappointing nature, and I mean, there are some good things to be reminded of in the book of Judges. Yes, there are some great things that we can emphasize if we had to pigeonhole one or the other, that it would be of a positive nature. But overall, the book is a sad tale, if you will, of some of Israel's darkest days. But despite that, I think the book opens rather well. Look at the first two verses of Judges chapter 1. We're back in Judges now. And we pick up after Joshua's death, came after the death of Joshua, that the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, saying, what did they inquire of the Lord? Yeah. Joshua's gone now, so who's going to go up first? So already they're undertaking the efforts to go and drive out the peoples, to go and drive out the lands. So they had a legitimate question. Who's going first? Well, they inquired of the Lord, and that's a positive occurrence. To inquire of the Lord, that it was a desire to know the will of God, and not just know His will, but know it before doing anything. Isn't that a good rule to follow? Before you ever do anything, what's the appropriate question to answer, or to ask and answer? What does God say about this? Does God have any feelings about this one way or the other? And if He does, then that needs to guide my decision before I act. And so this is commendable for them to do this. Now, I'm sort of asking, this is the thought question here, who would have been involved in such a decision? The high priest. And what would he have employed? All right, there's that idea of the Urim and the Thummim that we don't know much about in the Bible. But it involved those two stones that he wore in the breast piece or the breastplate on his ephod. And somehow that was involved in finding out the will of God on the matter. They would go to the high priest and they would inquire, does the Lord want us to do this? And from what I've been able to tell, it would involve questions that would have elicited a yes or no answer. Should we do this? Yes or no? What about this? Yes or no? And so the high priest would make inquiry. So I know the text doesn't say this, but that was the we're in the days of the covenant of Moses. And there's many other passages. Here's some on the chart there. You see them there in your question to Exodus 28, Numbers 27, and Judges 20. Would also give us some information outside the book of Judges about the high priest. Who Aaron, of course, was the first high priest. Then his son took over. His name was Eleazar. And then who was Eleazar's son? It had been Phinehas. So there's the priestly order. Now, not trivia, but just sort of for information purposes, was Eleazar Aaron's first son? Would he have been the rightful one to take Aaron's place? No. Who were Aaron's two sons that died? Nadab and Abihu, in that offering strange fire in Leviticus chapter 10. Eleazar was his third son. So them being dead, being punished by God, that left Eleazar then to fill the post when Aaron passed away. And so, and there's evidence in Joshua 14 that tells us that Eleazar assisted Joshua somewhat in helping him divide up the land by inheritance, so he was involved. How long he lived after Joshua's death, I don't know, but there's also some evidence that Phinehas served as high priest. So at some point, Eleazar was served as, or Joshua was served as high priest both by Eleazar and Phinehas. But we don't know exactly when that, who died when. But when Israel stood poised to take up Canaan some 40 years earlier, this is question three. Remember back in Numbers 13 and 14? They've come up from Mount Sinai with the covenant, and Moses sent the spies out. Those 12 spies, they were gone for 40 days. They met Moses and the nation back at Kadesh Barnea, and they brought back the report. They also brought back what? Some evidence of the fruitfulness of the land, and they also brought back some eyewitness testimony. What did they see? Besides the fatness of the land. They saw giants. They saw the Anakim, or the sons of Anak. And they said, we were but grasshoppers in their eyes. We just, this is really going to be tough. So 10 of the 12 spies said what? This is not good. We cannot do this. Two of the spies, whose names were Joshua, which we've been talking about, and Caleb. And we'll talk about Caleb too, here in the early chapter. They said, we must go up. So then, and this is all back in Numbers 13 and 14, basically God back then was saying what? Go take the land. Listen, I'm going to be fighting for you. I'll drive those nations out. You just need to learn to trust and depend upon me. Well, what happened? They didn't go take the land. And as a result, what had to happen? That whole generation was punished. They had to wander for 40 years. Now what are they doing? See, they're doing what they should have done some 40 to 45 years ago. So as you think about these efforts that are taking place now that they've been told to do, and that, again, Joshua has already undertaken somewhat. They have begun the process. That's the book of Joshua recounts all that. I thought it somewhat interesting to think about the level of their faith way back then. They had no faith. Despite Joshua and Caleb's cry to the people, we must not turn back now. We must do this because this is what God told us to do. The nation was punished because of her lack of faith. And now we see they are on the cusp, if you will, of fulfilling what they should have done 40 years prior. And the warnings, again, finish the job. Do not let the nations remain. So the same God who was with them then, although they didn't follow Him, He is with them now. And the warnings, the exhortations are, Be diligent in doing these duties. Be diligent in driving these nations out. And do not let them remain, because it will be a spiritual consequence to you if you do not. And Joshua 23, 3-5, again, gives some other information along these lines. Okay. Now, let's pick up our pace here. The rest of the section here, we're going to put verses 1 through 21 together and just kind of go through this point by point. Israel inquired as to who should go up first, and it revealed that Judah should go. And so After that's been determined, what did Judah do? All right, he asked Simeon for some help. And in fact, how did he put it? Basically, he said, if you help me, then I'll help you. See that there in verse 3. Come up, he says this to Simeon, come up with me into the territory allotted to me, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and then I in turn will go with you into the territory allotted to you. So you come help me, and I'll come help you. And apparently they did that, as you read the rest of chapter 1 here. Look at verses 4 through 7. Their initial efforts, they go and attack Bezek, and the king's name was Adonai Bezek. And they fought against him. You'll see there in verse 5. Did they have success? Yes, they did. They fought against him. The king, if I'm assuming he's the king or the ruler there, Adonai Bezek, he just didn't stay around. He fled. He ran from the battle scene. Did they capture him? They got him and brought him back. And what did they do to him? All right, they cut his thumbs off and his big toes. How big of a deal is that not to have your thumbs or your big toes? That's a big deal. That's right. Keeps your balance. And can you grab anything without a thumb? And that'd be really more than difficult. It just would be a terrible thing not to have thumbs or big toes. Well, why did they do this? Why did they cut off his thumbs and his big toes? Pardon? All right, it's a repayment to him. What in the text tells us that? In fact, who admits it? He does. He admits. He accepted his own punishment, saying, this is in verse 7, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to gather up scraps under my table. So in his reign, he had been somewhat cruel to those whom he had fought and defeated or captured. And I get the idea from the way verse 7 reads that even he kept humiliating them by making them just beg for scraps. And maybe got some amusement out of it. You're right, Freddie. I don't know. But that was his idea. So he concludes in verse 7 by saying, so as I have done, then what? That's what God's done to me, and he means it, of course, through the hands of the Jews here. Yes, Melvin. Mm-hmm. Thumbs are important. Absolutely. Absolutely. So what I'm asking here is somewhat of a biblical principle. Turn to the 7th Psalm. We'll do this real quickly. I didn't put these passages in the questions. Look at Psalm number 7 and see if we don't see somewhat of a biblical principle here that's taught in more than one place just in the Bible than just here. Psalm number 7. Norman, you have that. Will you please read for us verses 14 through 16? This is a psalm of David where he's talking about the wicked and sometimes how they mistreat the righteous. Psalm number 7 now, 14 through 16. Especially verse 16. What does the Bible say about the evil plots and plans of the wicked? They come back to him. And here's an example of that very thing. Look at the Lord's words in Matthew chapter 7. Now, I understand when Jesus is talking here in Matthew 7, he's talking about making judgments against others. But there's a principle behind these verses. What is the warning that we're told in verse 2 of Matthew 7? All right. With whatever measure of judgment that you exact upon others, it will be returned to you. Well, could we not say that Adonai Bezek made some sort of judgment here in this passage? Now, it's more of a physical nature than a mental judging, but the principle is still the same. And how was he judged? The way in which he treated others. I've got verse 12 also noted on the chart. What's the golden rule? All right. The way you want to be treated. Now, do you think he wanted his thumbs and big toes cut off? Well, I doubt it. So, you should treat others the way that you want to be treated. And so here we see a biblical principle at work that's even illustrated here in the early verses of the first chapter of Judges. All right, verse 8. They attacked Jerusalem. Or Jebus is the old name for the city of Jerusalem. And they captured the city and they set it on fire. It was at the end of Jebus or Jerusalem. No, it was not. It was not totally secure because look down in verse 21 of the book of Judges, chapter 1. What does it say about the Benjamites? Well, they didn't totally drive out the Jebusites. So if they captured the city and set it on fire, if that was a complete capture of the city and they killed everybody, then they wouldn't have this problem in verse 21. So it was not complete or total. But also, this is at the end of top of page... this is question 6, top of page 6. The city was not fully subjugated until whose reign? David's, and we know that from passages like 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verses 4 through 9, which you can read, when it finally and totally came under the rule of the Israelite king. So here we see some initial efforts to capture the city, plunder it, burn it. It doesn't say that they burned it to the ground. It says they set the city on fire, so it was not totally destroyed. But obviously they allowed some of the inhabitants or residents to remain because of other biblical texts that indicate that. So there are some of the initial efforts when they attacked Jerusalem. Verses 12 through 15, what did Caleb offer? By the way, what tribe is Caleb from? Do we remember? He was one of the spies. And all the spies are listed in Numbers 13 plus their tribe. Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, was from the tribe of Judah. So Judah is the one that's acting here in this early chapter of Judges. So he made an offer. What did he say, basically? All right, he's got a daughter he wants to get married. So he says, whoever captures what? This is starting in verse 12. All right, Kiriath-Sefer or Debir would be the old name, but... The former name was Kiriath-Sefer. Now the name is Debir. He says, whoever captures that gets my daughter. I'll give my daughter to the man as a wife. Well, who volunteers? Othniel or Othniel? He accepts the challenge. And he was Caleb's nephew. He was the son of Kenaz, who was Caleb's younger brother. And other passages, Numbers 13, and 1 Chronicles 4:13 give us information sort of who the family connections are there. Especially the passage in 1 Chronicles 4 tells us who the two sons of Kenaz was, and one of them was Othniel. And not only did he take the challenge, but what do we know about Othniel? He's the first judge. We'll read about him just in a couple of chapters. The first deliverer that God raised up to bring about an end to some oppressive behavior against his people. So there's Caleb's offer. Again, all this is being done in the context of Judah going up first. The Kenites, verse 16, what did they do? And how are they described in verse 16? Who are they? All right, they're Moses' kinfolks by marriage. They are the descendants of Moses' father-in-law, whose name was Reuel or Jethro, the Midianites. And so they lived in the city of palms, it says, and that's Jericho. So if you get a map, and I've got a map to show you just in a little bit, but they used to live there, but they moved southeast down to the lowlands, which are east of the Dead Sea. So they moved down there, the text tells us. And it says in Numbers 10 that they had earlier come to live with the Israelites. So do they assist any in conquering the land? Well, the verse does not say that they went to battle with them. But it just indicates that they moved down there in the area where they were fighting. I'm not sure what purpose that would have served to move there unless they had also maybe been doing some help or some assisting with the battle. The text doesn't say that, though. But we are told that they did move in that area as a sign of if you have trust or confidence in helping Judah claim all these territories. Verse 19, sort of a failure of Judah. What is mentioned in verse 19? Okay. The Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country, that is the high country. But you go further west, see, west toward the Great Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, away from the mountains in the lowlands there, and they ran into some opposition. Specifically what? Iron chariots. Iron chariots. And so the further west they went toward the Mediterranean Sea, they had to overcome the Canaanites and who had these iron chariots. Now, is the problem that God isn't with them any longer? Well, that's not it. So why did they fail? We have to do some concluding here. Verse doesn't say. Maybe not enough faith. I mean, there's something at work. It seems to be a lack of faith to do what God had commanded. Go back to Joshua 17. Let's look at that. I think that's interesting. I do have that verse listed in question 9. But in Joshua 17, verse 17, we had an earlier warning, if you will. Now, the sons of Joseph come to Joshua, this is verse 16, and they, I don't want to call this a complaint, but they had a request. Joshua 17, verse 16. Sons of Joseph said, "The hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the valley, land have chariots of iron." So already they knew of these iron chariots. Both those who were in Beth Shean and its towns, and those who are in the valley of Jezreel. Joshua spoke to the hand of, or to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, "You are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours, for though it is a forest, you shall clear it, and to its farthest borders," that means to the west, "it shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have what?" So this was known beforehand. It's not like we can come to Judges 1, "Oh, surprise, they've got iron chariots." No, that was known before. And the fact that they failed to drive them out, I think, indicates somewhat a lack of faith or a lack of duty to the command to drive these iron chariots out. Now, would that may have been a tougher battle than just fighting footmen? And so, well, probably so. But again, who's fighting for them? God. And keep in mind, Numbers 33, Joshua 23. What was the overall command to these nations? You've got to drive them out. You've got to get rid of them. Well, there's no indication that they inquired there. That could be true, James. Yes. Yes. Right, back in Numbers 13 and 14, a lack of faith. I think we must conclude something along those lines rather than say, well, God wasn't fighting. We can't say God wasn't fighting for them because that's just not the case. God would fight for these people. Gave them the command to drive them out, but they failed on this occasion. And then finally, in this first part, the promise to Caleb. There had been an earlier promise made to Caleb back in Joshua 14. After they began to take some of the inheritance, Caleb came to Joshua, as you recall. And he said, "I'm 85 now. I was 40 when you and I were spies together back at Kadesh Barnea. And I'm as strong today as I was back then." And he said, Moses sort of made me a promise. And so what did Caleb say? He said, "Give me this mountain. Give me this hill. I'm ready to take it." And so you come here in verse 20. They gave Hebron to Caleb, verse 20 says, as Moses had promised. So that had been said back there. And he drove out the Anakim. There's those giants, the same giants they saw back in Numbers 13 and 14. Caleb wasn't afraid of them back there. He's not afraid of them now. And he drives them out because he had great faith. One statement I'm going to pull back is Numbers 14:24. Remember what God said through Moses when he's giving out the punishments for their lack of faith at Kadesh Barnea? He said, except for Joshua and Caleb, everyone else will not enter him. But Caleb, he has a different spirit. And that doesn't mean miraculously. That means his faith, his spirit, his temperament was one of faith. He wanted to do what God said. He was unlike his brethren. You know, for us to be successful today, brethren, what do we have to have? We have to have a different spirit about us. Not like the world. We're going to have to dig our heels in sometimes. And though it's not popular or easy, we're going to have to do what God said. Do you have a comment, Doug, or a question? Okay. Yeah. Yes. Caleb was wholehearted. He had a different spirit about him. He was always willing to do what God says. So this is a kind of a dark map, I know, but let me just kind of go back and review what we've covered so far. I know the type is really small, and you probably can't even see that. But that's Shechem, or Shechem, right there. And I'm circling that because back in Joshua 20, if you look back in Joshua 20, 4 and verse 1, we're sort of bridging these two books together. When Joshua gives his farewell address, he calls all Israel to him where? At Shechem. That's where he gave this farewell speech. All right? And we're talking here in Judges 1, that bottom area right there, that's Judah and Simeon in Judah, as you look at a map that shows the apportionment of the 12 tribes. So let's enlarge that section right there. Maybe that's a little easier to see now we've got that sort of blown up. Here's some of the places that we've looked at so far already. There's Jerusalem up there, and that's the efforts that have already been described in this chapter. They also took... my eyes are bad tonight. There's Hebron. They took that. That's listed. And Debir, that's where Caleb made the offer. Whoever will go take Debir, I'll give him my daughter as a wife. Up here is Jericho. That's the city of the palms where the Kenites used to live. But as it said in this chapter, they moved south. And you see there on this map, there's the Kenites listed. And Arad is listed there in Judges chapter 1. That's where they settled when they came from up here down south along the western area of the Dead Sea. But other places listed here in Judges chapter 1, there's Hormah, that's also Zephath, that's listed here in the text. They took that. They took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. Those are Philistine cities, also, of course, farther west toward the Great Sea. All of these efforts were here in the southern part of Canaan. And by and large, their efforts here were successful or they failed. They were successful. By and large, they took the territories. They did capture the cities. But let's go a little north, just for sake of argument here. Again, down here. Here is, what is that? That's Bethel. All right. And that's listed. That was a success as well. But these now listed here in the blue circles. These are all areas we see at the last part of Judges, chapter 22, 1, 22 through 36. Whoop, went too fast there. These are all areas where we see they did not drive out the inhabitants of this city, this city, this city, and this city. Look at how all these statements read here in Judges chapter 1, starting in verse 27. Manasseh did take possession of the cities in his area. Verse 29. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites. Verse 30, Zebulun did not drive out the Canaanites. Verse 31, Asher didn't drive out the Canaanites. Verse 33, Naphtali didn't drive out the Canaanites. And this is said over and over and over again. That if you put those statements next to those earlier two passages, Numbers 33, Joshua 23, how do you match those together? God said, if you let them remain, it's going to be a problem. They didn't drive them out. What do you make of that? They didn't do what God said to do. Now, four times in this text, verses 28, 30, 33, and 35, last part of Judges chapter 1, it says that they forced these Canaanites into forced labor. They made them servants. So, could it be argued, well, they took possession of the land? Well, yes, I guess you could say that. But that wasn't what God said. He didn't say, go in there, take the land, and then you capture the people and you make them your hired laborers. He didn't say to do that. That's not what He said. That's right. As Doug mentioned earlier, God is using the nation of Israel there as a judgment tool against these Canaanites for their idolatrous lifestyle, their idolatrous practices. And so, yes, Israel took possession of the land. And yes, they did force inhabitants into forced labor. But remember these earlier commands. We see a difference between what God said. We could say in a physical sense, they did take the land. There was some success physically. But we're not just interested in physical success. We're more along the lines of, well, what about spiritually? If you let them remain, then what else remained? Their idols remained. And as we see starting in chapter 3, what is the problem? Every time God had to raise up a deliverer or a judge, why is that? Because they kept following after those idols. And that's the problem. And so all along, God knew what He was talking about. So there's sort of a run-through, if you will, of the first chapter. Sort of gives us a running start as to their initial efforts to drive out the nations. Some success, more success in the south than up north, but not total success because they did leave some of the peoples up there. So we'll stop there for the sake of time.